much older then. I'm younger than that now.
Hello again, I'm Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer, and this is Growing Bolder. And coming up in just a moment, we'll talk to the author of a book that has everyone talking. It's a manifesto against ageism.
Also, the NFL player battling to overcome two life-threatening health scares while preparing to face yet a third. Plus, the world-renowned researcher who says transcendental meditation can unlock a supermind in all of us. And a man with a 40-year history of heart disease will attempt to become the oldest ever to summit Mount Kilimanjaro.
And that is not all. We also have Diana Nyad, the first person in history to swim from Cuba to Florida without a shark cage, and she did it at the age of 64. All today on Growing Bolder.
Here on Growing Bolder, our stated mission is rebranding aging. And that's why we're excited to talk to our next guest. She is a journalist, an author, and an activist who is confronting many forms of ageism that exist in our society today.
Yeah, it's an interesting topic, Bill, because I think even those of us who are out there trying to fight it are ageist in ways we don't even realize. She's the author of a great new book called This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism. It's already a bestseller on Amazon, has received tremendous acclaim. Essentially, folks, it's a call to arms, imploring all of us, regardless of our age, to wake up to the ageism that not only surrounds us, but is inside of us. Let's find out more as we welcome Ashton Applewhite. Hey, Ashton, how are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for writing the book, and not just for writing This Chair Rocks, but believing in the message so much that you actually self-published it. And I know there's got to be a lot of publishers out there that are feeling foolish, but maybe given the degree of ageism that your book exposes, we probably shouldn't be surprised that publishers weren't exactly beating down your door initially.
A lot of them are just terrified of anything to do with aging. They equate it with decline and death. And I can't say I blame them. There are shelves in the bookstores that you see that say aging and death. And, aging is living. We're aging from the minute we're born. Dying is just what happens at the end of all that living.
You know, Ashton, there are so many stories out there, so many things you could have chosen to dive into. What put you on the path to writing This Chair Rocks and trying to reframe the way we all see age and aging?
Well, it's funny because if you had told me 10 years ago that I would be mesmerized by this subject, I would have thought, you must be crazy. It must be really depressing, and old people must be sad and lonely because they're going to die soon. And, it obviously looks terrible to be old. And then I started a project called So When Are You Going to Retire? About people over 80 and 90 in the workforce, inspired by my in-laws. And I started interviewing older people, and they were a dime a dozen, and they were amazing, which didn't really surprise me. But what did surprise me was that I also started researching and reading about longevity. And everything I learned was so much more, not just more nuanced, but more positive than what I thought. I mean, for example, I thought the odds of ending up in a nursing home were, pretty good. Turns out that the percentage of American population over 65 in nursing homes is 4%, and it's dropping. And I thought older people must be depressed because they were old and they were going to die soon. Older people have better mental health than the young or middle-aged. And there's this thing called the U-curve of happiness. Google it. I didn't believe it either. I thought they must have cornered two octogenarians and given them a cookie and said, how are you feeling? Study after study in the U.S. and around the world shows that people are happiest at the beginnings and the ends of their lives. And I started to think, why don't we know this stuff? And the reason is because we live in a culture that drowns out all but the negative about late life. Because if aging is a disease, which it is not, then they can sell you remedies to fix it. And if aging is a cosmetic or personal problem, then they can sell you fixes. And if we see it as neither, we're a lot better off, and it's much truer to the reality as we get older. I don't know about you, but I hit all these ages. I'm 63, that I was conditioned to dread, and I hit 40 and 50 and 60, and I'm having a really good time.
You know, we love, this is maybe our favorite conversation, Ashton, because, you know, as we say all the time, we've been brainwashed. And, you know, we're all about, we're about the same age. You know, from the picture books that were read to us when we were kids, we just don't know what aging can be. And I love what you say about, you know, all of this age-defying and anti-aging garbage that is out there, because we really just need to define aging. The people that are living bold, exciting, productive, passionate lives into their 70s and 80s and 90s are everywhere, aren't they?
They are everywhere. I mean, I think it's important not to whitewash it. You know, there's lots about aging that is difficult. I mean, we are all worried about, you know, maybe running out of money, maybe ending up alone, maybe getting sick. And those fears are legitimate. You know, they're real, and we need to address that. But our fears are so out of proportion to the reality. You know, everyone thinks if they can't remember the name of the movie they went to see with so-and-so last week, that they have Alzheimer's. And, you know, Alzheimer's is a real problem, but only 1 out of 9 Americans get it, usually in very late life, right? So, you know, the real epidemic in that case is anxiety over memory loss. And we allow these fears that are fed by the media and the medical establishment and the cosmetics industry to overwhelm us and fill us with a dread that is, it segregates us, it fills us with needless anxiety, and, you know, it really damages our whole life course.
You know, one of the things about ageism that makes it difficult to combat is that when you say the word, everybody goes, oh, yeah, that's ridiculous, yet a lot of us practice it without even realizing it. Mark brought that up in the intro too. How are some of the ways we do that, and who really is the enemy?
Well, I'm very glad you say that, because I wrote a book, you know, which is a manifesto. It's a call for social change, but all change starts inside us, between our ears. And when you grow up in a culture that, you know, describes old people as, you know, lazy or useless or unattractive, when we're barraged by messages that start, as you pointed out, with children's books, you know, with the wicked grannies and the Homer Simpson grandpas and all of that, when it's not counteracted by more positive messages, and then when you grow up in a very age-segregated society, which this is, you incorporate those ideas into your own sense of identity. You know, this idea that the older you is less valuable than the younger you, less attractive, less whatever. And that is crazy, you know, so when we, every time we make a senior moment joke, every time we think, oh, you know, these wrinkles really make me less of a person, every time we lie about our age, every time we even, you know, dyeing our hair, I understand why people do it. It's a really effective strategy to stay visible in an ageist world. But when we do that, we are validating the notion that our younger self is more valuable than our older one. And that damages us, right? And it's not true. So the very first step is to look at your own language, how you think about older people, and how you see yourself getting old. And is it accurate, or is it really, really negative? And where do those ideas come from?
We're talking with Ashton Applewhite, who has written just a fabulous new book. It's called This Chair Rocks, A Manifesto Against Ageism, where she pretty much pulls the cover back and reveals how all of us, to some extent, don't really know what's possible. And Ashton, from the anti-aging commercials that we see every day to the institutionalized ageism in the insurance industry to mandatory retirement ages to prescribing medicine before lifestyle modification, what do you think is the most troubling, most dangerous examples of ageism in our society today?
Well, I would go back to the internalized ageism. You know, this idea when someone calls us, you know, calls me young lady, and I'm supposed to think it's a compliment, for example. You know, this idea that I should wish to be younger than I am. If you ask people whether they really want to move their piece on the board back to zero, you know, if you couldn't take your consciousness with it, we don't want to. So, you know, because we are the product of all our experiences, we see age, it's framed by the forces that you talk about, as this endless process of loss, whereas we contain all the ages we have ever been. All those selves are accessible to us. And age, in that sense, is an additive process. You know, it's an enrichment. We have all these experiences, all these relationships that we are able to draw on the longer we live. So I want people to think, and that's what growing older tells us. As we reach these ages, we know that it's not all decline the way it's painted in the media. So I want people to think, gee, if my experience is different, why am I buying all these messages from consumer culture and from the insurance agency and from medical establishments that I'm broken and I'm sick and I'm not worth as much as I used to be? Because that is not how we want to be in the world, and we need to push back personally, and we need to see that these feelings of loss and loss of self-worth, they're not personal problems. They're not because we didn't use the right wrinkle cream or we didn't do enough sit-ups or eat enough kale. They are a function of discrimination in society. They are widely shared political problems that we need to join together to push back against, just like women did in the 1960s and 70s to challenge the sexism that was making their life narrow.
Well, there's no question we all have a stake in this game, no matter what our age is. Ashton, in our last 30 seconds, what can we do? What's the first step we all need to take to confront this in our own lives?
Oh, geez. I hate to say it, but buy my book. It's really good. Read the reviews on Amazon. It's really lively, and I guarantee that it will change the way you think about the rest of your life. And if you want to go forward and take action on it, I tell you how, and it sure makes the future look a lot more interesting and a lot more exciting.
Now, preach on, Sister Ashton Applewhite.
Join the movement.
It is a great book. She is Ashton Applewhite. Her book is This Chair Rocks, and it pretty much reveals the ageism that is literally taking not only years from our lives, but quality of life from our years. Check it out. Join the revolution as we work to not only deny or defy aging, but to define aging for what it actually is, a time of growth and opportunity. Her website, by the way, is thischairrocks.com. Thanks so much to Ashton Applewhite. Coming up, the former NFL star who's gone from battling to save his leg to battling to save his life. His inspiring comeback is next on Growing Bolder.
Support for Growing Bolder provided by
Savings accounts should build wealth, not add expenses. Raisin gives savers access to high-yield savings accounts, money market deposit accounts, and certificates of deposit from over 70 banks and credit unions. Find, fund, and manage multiple savings products all through a single secure login. More information at raisin.com/growingbolder.
Mark Middleton and Bill Schaefer back here with more of Growing Bolder. It's no secret, folks, that the NFL is a pretty brutal way to make a living, and we're only now learning the possible extent of the damage. It's been widely reported that the average lifespan of former players is only 55 to 60 years old, and now there's this fear of CTE, the deadly degenerative brain disease.
Yeah, it can only be confirmed post-mortem, so we really don't know how many players have it, but we do know that Kenny Stabler, Frank Gifford, Junior Seau, John Mackey, Mike Webster, and many, many more had it when they died. Which brings us to Reggie Williams, the former NFL linebacker whose bid to run again on a badly damaged leg we reported on 2 years ago. We caught up with Reggie recently and found a still highly motivated, highly inspiring warrior despite two serious setbacks and the growing specter of CTE. Former NFL great Reggie Williams is visiting his son Julian, a top-ranked mixed martial arts star, at his new gym in Orlando. The last time we caught up with Reggie, he was just days away from achieving his dream, running for the first time in 10 years on a leg that doctors said should be amputated. He had overcome 24 serious operations and multiple life-threatening infections that left his right leg nearly 4 inches shorter than his left. And he wasn't just going to run, he was going to do it in front of the fans he loved and who loved him back.
I was finally going to have an opportunity to go back to Cincinnati in front of the Bengals before a big game.
The date was set. Reggie was ready. But then, disaster.
I know pain in my life. And so this wasn't pain, this was something just went wrong.
He was rushed to the hospital where doctors diagnosed an aortic dissection, a major tear in the large blood vessel that carries blood out of the heart.
And normally when that happens, you have a 99% chance of dying within 24 hours.
Reggie defied the odds, surviving emergency surgery.
So now, I have this nice scar, okay? You know, it's a reminder of how blessed the opportunities in lives are and how fleeting and quickly it can all be taken away from you.
Reggie slowly regained his strength and his determination to run, but on New Year's Eve of this year, disaster struck again.
And all of a sudden, my right arm started going in its own motion, doing everything. I was like, what is going on here? I started to notice that my speech was slurring. And so quickly I realized I'm in trouble again. And I was having a stroke.
He was rushed to the hospital again, and by the time he arrived, he couldn't speak.
I couldn't give my phone number. I couldn't give the name of my son, Julian, or anyone in my family, my mom or dad. And it was very scary.
He was in the hospital for 5 days. Medication dissolved the blood clots in his brain, but it took months of therapy to regain the ability to speak.
This is a milestone. To be able to, talk a few months after a critical, impact to your capacity to speak.
Reggie hopes his major health scares are behind him, but he acknowledges that 14 years as one of the NFL's hardest-hitting linebackers makes him a likely candidate for CTE, the progressive degenerative brain disease found in athletes with a history of repetitive brain trauma.
And you think about all the rules that have been outlawed now, were legal then. You could head slap, you could, in a lot of circumstances, use the face mask, you could clothesline, you could horse collar tackle, you could hit high, you could hit low, you could blindside hit. So, you rang the bell, of the concussions on a regular basis. And so practice is where you hone those skills. And there were a lot of players that didn't make it out of practice, much less, had their concussions on an NFL field. I would bet that I will have CTC. But the question is, what am I doing or what have I done so that I just haven't currently been negatively impacted in terms of my daily lifestyle by it?
Reggie believes that he has an obligation to his NFL brethren to not only delay or prevent CTE, but to successfully live with it should he be diagnosed.
What are things that I can do now to pre-rehab for the probability of more brain damage? And so it seems like those who have been through the mill, through the gauntlet, can shed a lot of light to how to optimize your ability to survive.
In the wake of his aortic dissection, his major stroke, and growing concerns about CTE, Reggie Williams is focusing once again on his dream of running onto a football field, and he spontaneously decides to attempt to take his first few strides in more than 11 years.
I might take 2 steps. I might take 4 steps. I don't know how many steps, but there's got to be progress. It's got to be that day that you actually do it. So this might be that day.
If he can jog just 1 step, it will be a major milestone in his impossible dream. His first attempt is a failure. And he's not discouraged for even a second. This is a man who never gives up. He changes locations, adjusts his technique, and tries again. It's not quite the speed with which he used to get into the backfield, but the thrill may be even greater than sacking Joe Montana.
I still have the dream of running on the field, and yet the dream of staying alive obviously is greater,
Reggie Williams is a man who has defied the odds against him his entire life, and despite the prospect of another major battle ahead, he remains optimistic, a willing warrior, ready for whatever life throws his way. Up next, unlocking your super mind. One of the world's most respected researchers says he's found the path to higher human consciousness. This is Growing Bolder. We've got news. Watch.growingbolder.com, the world's first streaming site for active adults, is now live. Growing Bolder TV shows, national specials, documentaries, and inspiring videos on ordinary people living extraordinary lives 24/7 on demand for free. Watch.growingbolder.com is now live.
Transcendental meditation, we've all heard of it. It first became popular in this country back in the 60s when the Beatles traveled to India to practice it with its founder. But boy, it's turned out to be anything but a fad. In fact, TM is now more popular than ever, and hundreds of published studies have proven that it has many benefits.
Yeah, you're right, Bill. In fact, it's now being called a tool of personal transformation by many, including Dr. Norman E. Rosenthal, who's an internationally acclaimed psychiatrist, researcher, educator, and New York Times best-selling author of 8 books, including his latest, Supermind, How to Boost Performance and Live a Richer and Happier Life Through Transcendental Meditation. He's a clinical professor of psychiatry at Georgetown University School of Medicine. You've seen him on Good Morning America, The Today Show, NPR, Dr. Oz, and many others. And we're going to chat with him now. So let's welcome Dr. Norman E. Rosenthal. Hey, Doc, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
Well, we're doing fine, and we appreciate what you're doing to spread the word about transcendental meditation. And before we talk about its benefits, because it seems so simple, and yet it can be so difficult, isn't that the overall goal of TM, basically to kind of get the frenetic monkey brain that we all have to slow down?
Well, I think that it does seem simple. But like many things that seem simple, it just takes a little bit of practice, a little bit of trickery. I mean, there's a trick to it. So it's a mantra is given to you by somebody who routinely teaches it. You're taught how to think the mantra, and then you're off and running. But they just it's like if you ski down a gentle slope. It's effortless in a way because gravity is pulling you down. But you may just need to learn how to maneuver the legs a little so that you don't trip or whatever. Not that you can trip thinking a mantra, but this way you get to that transcendent place. And once you're there, you're going to want to keep meditating.
Now, this is a really interesting book, Supermind is, because it's not a how-to book on TM. I mean, you state very clearly that the techniques cannot be learned in a book, that we need a qualified teacher.
Yeah, you know, when people ask me if it's a how-to book, I say, look, it's a why-to book, because the most precious asset that we have, and it's finite, is our time. And if you're going to be spending 20 minutes twice a day, and you really need to if you want to get that super mind that the book is advertising, you really need to put in that amount of time. You have to be pretty well persuaded that it's worth it. And I know personally, I would say I almost never miss a day. And it's not really because I'm such a disciplined person. It's just because I've learned that I don't want to only get the benefits of the meditation itself. I want to get the benefits of the growing of the mind and the growing of consciousness that come with it. So before you're willing to do that, you should at least hear what are the benefits. Hear some testimonials, listen, read about a survey of more than 600 people who meditate, who describe what happens to them. And so it is a why-to and not a how-to book. And I think what I have been impressed with is how many people in the book and elsewhere who are so functional and so successful nevertheless find the time, because the time repays itself in better efficiency and in a better quality of living.
You know, it's a great description of what the book is, folks. If you're curious about transcendental meditation, this will push you over the edge and make you want to learn the techniques. So give us some of the benefits, because you espouse many, many benefits, physical, psychological, spiritual, emotional. What are some of, in your estimation, doctor, the most important benefits of doing TM?
Yes, and I think, you know, the best way I can do that is just to go down the chapter headings, connecting the body and mind. It has amazing benefits for physical well-being, including, for example, decreasing cardiovascular disease. That's been very thoroughly established. Building a better brain, improving memory, creativity, efficiency. Being in the zone, that's kind of an interesting one. I know performing artists and athletes value it highly, but for all of us, being in the zone is often a great thing. Internal growth. For example, an interview I had with Hugh Jackman, he spoke about how authenticity is something he learned through meditation, which he ranks right up there with marriage and family as one of the best things he's ever done, learning who he really is. So becoming an authentic person, but also looking at yourself and saying, you know, I know this is who I really am, but who do I really want to become? Maybe I don't like everything about myself. Maybe I want to change some things. That can be facilitated through the supermind. Engagement and detachment. You know, Freud said to love and to work are the two great goals, and we were kind of taught in that vein. You've got to be engaged with people. You've got to be engaged with your work. But what if a relationship isn't working? And what if a career isn't your best thing for you to do? How do you know when to hold them and when to fold them? How do you know when you need to detach? How do you detach? How do you extricate yourself gracefully? And how do you deal with the necessary loss involved in that process? Then there are two chapters at the end of this series, which I know will be lightning rods for your listeners, and that is meditate and grow rich and meditate and be happy. And these, of course, are goals that many of us have. The last thing you might think of when you think of how do I grow rich is to, well, let me start meditating, then the money will pile up. Seems a little far-fetched because, you know, most get-rich books give you specific advice. You know, pay yourself first, get a good money manager, so on and so forth. But this doesn't give you specific guidance, but it says, your mind is going to become more effective. You're going to listen to your clients better. You're going to be more organized and efficient. They're going to pick up from you that you're less stressed and you're more happy and confident. We are more likely to trust and invest with a confident, happy person than with a grouchy, snappy person. And so these are things that the supermind can do. And I'm happy to elaborate on any or all.
Well, how about elaborating on this a little bit, because you talk a lot in the book how TM leads to expanded states of consciousness. What exactly, mm-hmm. What exactly is that?
Well, that's a great question. And actually, had anybody said this to me 5 years ago, I would have been very, very dubious. You know, one often has to experience something oneself before one can be convinced. What happens in the actual TM session itself is that you go into a state called transcendence, where you're alert but you're calm. It's a very paradoxical thing, and the alertness doesn't have any content in it. There aren't any specific thoughts, but if a pin dropped, you'd hear it, and it's very blissful. It's almost like you've gone in a diving bell down into the depths of yourself, and the discovery there is that you're actually quite a nice guy. You've got a lot of nice things. You're kind, you're loving, you've got good things. But when we're stressed, it's hard to access those things. And by repeatedly meditating, we de-stress ourselves. And that kind of feeling that you normally just are getting in your transcendent states during meditation begins to infuse your daily life, so that as you're going about stuff, right now I'm talking with you about something that I'm really passionate about. I love chatting with you, but I'm also feeling a kind of blissful calm, side by side, like you're operating on two channels, but they're not interfering with each other. You're maintaining a sense of calm steadiness in the face of the ups and downs that life presents.
Well, you are inducing a state of blissful calm in us right now. Now, folks, we're talking with Dr. Norman E. Rosenthal. And, Doc, we've just got about 45 seconds left. You talk about, and you mentioned in your book, you tell the stories of super performers, and I know we don't have time to go into it now, but you say that TM can be a pathway for all of us to not only become more creative, but more successful in our business as well.
Yes, absolutely. And may I take 3 seconds just to tell my website, which is normanrosenthal.com. I have spoken to business people, including wealth managers in Manhattan, including the hedge fund manager Ray Dalio, including a woman who makes chandeliers in Manhattan and a high-end jeweler who's done brilliantly. All meditate and all say, my business works better, I've been more productive, people like me, my personnel works harder, I subsidize their meditation too because then my whole business performs better. And it's a pattern that once people do it in an organization, had breakfast yesterday with a brilliant prima ballerina from the New York City Ballet, Megan Fairchild. Her story is profiled in the book. But what she tells me is that now, 8 other dancers have already learned to meditate once they saw what happened with her, and now there's a desire to have the whole group of principal dancers learn to meditate. It's a kind of thing that spreads. You know, when you find a fabulous restaurant, you want to go tell all your friends about it? It inspires a generosity. It's not like, oh, I've got the secret and I want to hold on to it because I want to keep my competitive edge. It makes you feel generous, and that is a wonderful trait in business and in life.
He is Dr. Norman Rosenthal. His new book is Supermind. If you're looking to improve any aspect of your life, it will get you motivated. Thanks, Doc.
Up next, the power of perseverance. Diana Nyad joins us to talk about becoming the first person to swim from Cuba to the U.S. without a shark cage, and she did it at the age of 64. Growing Bolder and Humana are celebrating the opportunity of aging and smashing stereotypes with the new 65 Plus. We're sharing examples of people 65 and older who are pursuing their passions and leading happy, healthy, and active lives. You can inspire others by sharing your own photos and stories. Find more information at growingbolder.com/new65plus.
My guard stood hard when abstract threats to noble to neglect.
You're listening to Growing Bolder. I'm Mark Middleton along with Bill Schaefer. And as you folks know, one of our slogans is dream, believe, persist. Yeah, all of us like to dream, but far fewer truly believe in their dream to the extent that they are willing to persist for years or even decades to see it come true.
You know, that's true, Mark, but our next guest is a well-known exception to that. One of the world's greatest long-distance swimmers in the 70s. She dreamed of becoming the first person to swim from Cuba to the U.S. without a shark cage. It took her 5 tries and 35 years before she achieved her dream at the age of 64.
Unbelievably inspiring. She's been a national sports broadcaster and a journalist. She's a powerful motivational speaker and a best-selling author. And her new memoir is Find a Way, One Wild and Precious Life, tells a fascinating story of a life filled with challenge, struggle, abuse, and of course, unprecedented success. Let's welcome the great Diana Nyad. Hey, Diana, how are you?
Mark and Bill, it's such a pleasure to be with you. And you know what? I love that. I've heard all kinds of, as you can imagine, motivational phrases through the years, and I've started a few of them myself. But dream, believe, persist. It's the exact right order, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the pathway to success, and we love getting you on because it really was what you followed. And as Bill mentioned, you made your first attempt at a Cuba to U.S. Crossing when you were 29, back in 1978, and because of rough seas, you only made it halfway. The dream went dormant for decades. What brought it back, Diana?
You know, I first of all, that swim, you know, when I was a kid, when I was younger, my 20s, I held a number of world records out in the open ocean, Manhattan Island, et cetera, et cetera. But Cuba was always bigger than sport for me. Cuba, in my mind, was having to touch every fiber of your potential, dig down to every drop of your courage. It was like the emblem of living life large. It wasn't just another sporting event to me. And, you know, I had to leave it behind. As you just, you know, reported, I didn't make it. I was 28 years old. I was brash, cocky. I walked down to the Cuban shore like, hey, sharks, get out of my way. And 42 hours later, I was humbled. That is a vast, dangerous wilderness out there. People had been trying since 1950, and I found out the hard way why nobody had ever made it. And I went to work. I was 30 years old. It's time to retire. Most world-class athletes, you know, it's time to move on to some other aspect of your life. And I worked as a sports broadcaster all those years. And toward the end of that, I was turning 60. My mom had just died. I just met Christopher Reeve as a quadriplegic. He had a lot to say about regrets. Don't leave anything behind while you can still do it. And I just thought, you know what? I'm going to go back. I'm going to feel alive and awake and alert, and I'm going to chase that big, maybe impossible dream of mine, Cuba.
And this is at the age of 60. And Diana, you know, you three more attempts failed. Anybody else would have said, look, this is just a sign. Maybe this is not my thing. And I think, you know, it made national news each time. And I think people sort of get that it's a long distance, but have no idea about all the obstacles, the asthma attacks, the paralyzing and excruciating jellyfish stings. Did you ever start to think, you know, maybe I should find some other milestone to go for?
Well, you know, I didn't, but I must say everybody around me did. And I wasn't in an immature sort of, I'm going to show you, you know, I'm going to point in your face and say, I told you so. I told you I could make it across. It wasn't like that, but people for good reasons, my team, my teammates, you know, who had been through hell and high water with me, just felt that if anybody could have made it, it would have been me, but it just couldn't be done. There are too many variables out there. There's Mother Nature is raging on steroids across there with the current, the sharks, the jellyfish, the eddies within the current. The weather is unpredictable. Winds come off Africa 7,000 miles and literally blow the dust of the Sahara Desert across the north shore of Cuba. I mean, it's a crazy wilderness out there, but I'll tell you the truth. This is absolute truth. I never lost faith in it. You know, CNN joked after a while and said, you know, it looks like you're going to be 90 and still trying this swim. And, you know, if you ever make it to the other shore, we'll be there waiting for you. But we just can't. We can't put our resources into following you around anymore. I think the moral of the tale, and that's what those thousands of people who were on the beach, they were weeping when my team and I walked up. It's the moral of the tale is it doesn't matter what you're fighting. It might be cancer. It might be you lost your job. It might be you're dealing with a difficult teenager. It might be that you always said you were going to write that great American novel and you never did. You stuffed it into a back of a drawer. If you just don't give up, you will get to whatever that other shore of yours is.
Folks, she is powered by passion. You can hear it in her voice. We're speaking with the great Diana Nyad, who's written a fascinating memoir called Find a Way, One Wild and Precious Life. And Diana, you really mentioned one of the three things that you said when you stumbled onto the beach in Key West after swimming 110 miles in 53 hours, totally spontaneously, unrehearsed. You get up and you say what you just said, never, ever give up. And then you said something about never being too old. I love that one. Will you share some of that with us?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll tell you the truth. I'm sure you guys could understand this. In all those lonely, long, grueling hours of training, I admit that one of the things I did to sort of, you know, take my mind off the gruel of it all was to imagine the great oration that I would make when I finally made it to that other shore. But it didn't work out like that. It was spontaneous. I was dazed emotionally. I was ripped physically. And I think when I got up there, I'd never practiced those words. I never thought of them before. They came spilling out. And as you say, the first were, never, ever give up. And those people were screaming. They were weeping. They get it. They feel it for their own lives. The second thing I said was, you're never too old to chase your dreams. And you know what? I think that's true of every age. You're never too young to chase your dreams either. We're all living on this one-way street, aren't we? You can't ever do this day over again. You're going to get to the end, whether you're going to be 85 or 95 or 105, and your goal is to not look back and say, I should have, I could have, I wish I had. You want to get to the end with zero regrets. And the way you do that is don't believe that age is a limitation. No matter what your age is, it's not a limitation. I truly think I'm a better athlete in my 60s than I was in my 20s. I truly believe it. The third thing I said on that beach was I looked around me, 44 people, my team. We're talking about the top shark experts in the world, the jellyfish experts, my best friend Bonnie, the navigation genius, John Bartlett. I looked around and said, I know, it looks like the most solitary endeavor you've ever seen. There's only one swimmer out there. There's only one pair of arms that go left arm, right arm, hundreds of thousands of times. But trust me, never in a million years would I made it here without this team. And that's the truth.
Diana, I'm going to tease our viewers with the hope that we can get you back on because I know you've got something next planned. You're talking about a big walk. We don't have time to talk about that now. Can we get you back on the radio show in the near future?
Let's do it. I'd love it. And we're going to do a walk, by the way, Orlando to Miami. It's going to be a big series of walks called Everwalk. Just check it out, everwalk.com. And at one point, we're going to go Orlando to Miami and expect Mark, you and Bill to be at the front of the pack with us.
We'll be there, folks. She is Diana Nyad. Her new memoir is a must read. You can find out more at Diana Nyad. That's NYAD.com. Thanks, Diana. Up next, the amazing story of an 85-year-old man with a four-decade history of heart disease attempting to climb the world's highest freestanding mountain. That's next on Growing Boulder.
Sign up for the Growing Boulder Insider newsletter, delivered to your inbox every week. Be the first to see our latest interviews, stories, and tips for making each day count. Sign up today at growingboulder.com. Miss an episode of Growing Boulder Radio? Subscribe to our podcast and get it on your mobile device. Details at growingboulder.com/podcasts. The following interview was recorded before the passing of our guest.
And our next guest had three heart attacks by the time he was 45. And when his identical twin brother died of a heart attack at the age of 45, he began to live a life of fear.
And live, and live, and live, because today he's 85. And while, yes, he still suffers from heart disease, he says he's in the best shape of his life, and he is ready to prove it in just a couple of months when he hopes to become the oldest man on record to summit Mount Kilimanjaro, the world's highest freestanding mountain. We got to find out what makes this guy tick. Welcome to Dr. Paul Maggelli. Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm terrific. Great to hear from you guys.
I mean, the intro that Mark has talked about you, what are you doing? Why aren't you just sitting home protecting yourself in every way possible from any kind of heart problem?
I told my colleagues, I'm definitely not a golden Kiwani. One who's going to sit around and, you know, drink that easy coffee. So, no, I decided that once I was going to live, that I was going to live every day to the fullest. And I live by an interesting mantra that promise me tomorrow, because tomorrow's promised to no one. So I take advantage of every living day.
And your reason for climbing is many, and all of them are pretty cool. You're part of a Mayo Clinic team that's climbing to study heart disease and aging. Do you feel, Doc, a little bit like a guinea pig?
I volunteered for quite a number of studies for Mayo Clinic. If I were going to redo it, I'd become a physician rather than a professor of economics. And so there's a curiosity about me in the sense of how much I realize we really don't know about health, how mysterious it is yet. And as a result of that, when Mayo proposes a study of this kind, I said, count me in. And if we can answer a few of the questions and reduce the mystery to perhaps at least we think, I think, you know, I validated my purpose for, you know, still being alive.
You know, Dr. Majelle, you're full of optimism and you sound great on the radio here, but there's another layer to your story that we do want to throw out there, because this won't be your first time on Mount Kilimanjaro. Your team tried but couldn't quite reach the summit in 2011. So how that must be going through your mind at 85 years old to try it again?
Well, you know, I discovered that there were, first of all, I had a fundamental fear of heights. And so my son introduced me to Machu Picchu, and we did that in 22 days. And I discovered then that it was a fear that was unfounded in many ways. And so when he asked me to go see the sun rise on Kilimanjaro, I said, sure, why not? I discovered four things about climbing that I would like to share with people. There's the physical, the physiological, the psychological, and then the more curious one that I'll talk about in just a moment called the logistics of it all. Psychologically, you have to prepare yourself. You know, and really, anyone can climb Mount Kilimanjaro, and I don't say that facetiously. It's a climb, but it's not scaling. There's nothing technical really about it. The second thing is the physical, and that's the knees and the ankle and the hips. And if you prepare, I think you can overcome that. Then there's the physiological, the blood pressure, the pulse rates, and so forth. And quite honestly, being, you know, working out on the treadmill and keeping in shape addresses that. The one I found interesting is the logistical, the mystery of the climb. For example, it took us 87 miles to get to the near the top the last time, because you go through all of these, you circumvent and move around. And so if you can think about it in those four, the context of those four aspects, it's quite honestly, it's more and more people are capable of doing it than I think probably assume. I always say, if there's someone older than me going to try it, make sure he's not behind me, that he's in front of me, because I'm going after that person.
We're talking to Dr. Paul Majelle, who will attempt to become the oldest person to summit Mount Kilimanjaro coming up. And, you know, Doc, I got to ask you this. With your history of cardiac disease, will you have some sort of defibrillator with you? I mean, are you, because once you get 5-6 days into this climb and you realize it takes you a while to get back down, I think it would play on your mind a little bit.
Well, fortunately, I'm with Mayo Clinic, and I'm with physicians and physicians who've had experience, you know, at altitude. And, you know, as you know, Conrad Anker, Mr. Everest, is going with us. And so he certainly would be a non-medical judge in terms of how things are going. And then, of course, Dr. Bruce Johnson, who's head of the Extreme Physiology Lab at Mayo Clinic, will be with us. And he has been with Conrad Anker on Everest and on other mountains. And the last time, quite honestly, I should have summited. But the physician with me became a bit disoriented, because hallucination is one of the things you can suffer up there. And it turned out later he was hallucinating. And I should have proceeded, but, of course, then it would have been foolish to go against a physician's, you know, advice.
Hey, Doc, we're down to our final 20 seconds. Give us a takeaway. What have you learned about life through your experiences?
What have I learned about life? That there's a line from a wonderful song that's called, "Remember This, Each New Day's a Kiss, Sent from Up Above with an Angel's Love. Live every day as a gift."
And We're going to leave you with this, folks. Before you think you're too old, too tired, or too weak to take an adventure, learn something new, start a new relationship, repair an old relationship, start a new career, remember that what you put into your mind, you're also putting into your body. It's a fact proven by countless research studies. It's not your age that matters, it's your attitude. So be positive, be passionate, and be persistent, because that's Growing Bolder. We'll see you next time.
The Growing Bolder Radio Show is a production of Growing Bolder, LLC, all rights reserved. This program was recorded at Growing Bolder Studios in Orlando and is available as a weekly podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Spotify, and TuneIn. It is written and produced by Jill Middleton, Mark Middleton, and Bill Schaefer. Technical director is Jason Morrow. Production manager is Michael Nanis. Chief audio engineer is Mac Dula, and our most important team member, you. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram to keep growing bolder every day.
Crimson flames tied through my ears, flowing high and mighty traps. Countless fires.